This is XTP Media.
Prime Minister.
Mr. Speaker, sir, the House meets this Saturday to respond to a situation of great gravity. We are here because for the first time for many years, British sovereign territory has been invaded by a foreign power. After several days of rising tension in our relations with Argentina, that country's armed forces attacked the Falkland Islands yesterday and established military control of the islands. I must tell the House that the Falkland Islands and their dependencies remain British territory. No aggression and no invasion can alter that simple fact. It is the government's objective to see that the islands are freed from occupation and are returned to British administration at the earliest possible moment.
Air power during the Falklands conflict in 1982 was pivotal, both to the Argentine defence of the islands and the UK forces' efforts to take them back. UK air assets from the Royal Air Force, Army Air Corps, Royal Marines, and particularly the Royal Navy's Fleet Air Arm took part, as did aircraft from Argentina's Air Force, Navy, Army and Coast Guard. Air superiority was critical to both sides' chances of success. Without air superiority, it would have been impossible for British forces to carry out amphibious landings. British forces had to prevent attacks on the naval, amphibious and ground forces, and both sides had to transport thousands of men and thousands of tons of material by air. The British task force had hoped to reach their objective in secret, but to the Royal Navy's surprise, the Argentinians were able to use British communications satellite signals and Boeing 707 airliners to locate the fleet in transit. The first time opposing aircraft made contact was on the 21st of April, when a 707 was intercepted and shepherded away by Sea Harriers. The first actual combat involving aircraft came 4 days later, when Royal Navy helicopters crippled the submarine Santa Fe with depth charges and missiles during the operation to recover South Georgia. Taking the Falkland Islands themselves relied on every single air asset the British could bring to bear. Hastily modified RAF Victor tankers and Nimrods from 42 Squadron deployed to Ascension Island for reconnaissance and support of Royal Navy nuclear submarines. Long-range Black Buck Vulcan bombing raids, supported by Victor tankers, were a huge undertaking that successfully damaged the runway at Port Stanley and compromised the Argentinian air defence. The Argentine naval and air force fast jets were in less than ideal condition due to arms embargoes, but were still able to mount a formidable opposition. The Navy made good use of a small number of Exocet anti-ship missiles, with good cooperation between strike and reconnaissance aircraft, sinking the destroyer HMS Sheffield and the transport ship Atlantic Conveyor, the latter leading to the loss of many vital British helicopters. On the 21st of May, D-Day for the amphibious landings, naval and air force fighter bombers were able to penetrate British defences repeatedly, leading to the landing zone at San Carlos Water being nicknamed Bomb Alley. Fortunately, for the success of the operation, the brunt of the attacks was borne by the escorting warships and not the troopships and amphibious warfare vessels, but the Argentine fighter bombers did considerable damage. The Fleet Air Arm Sea Harriers proved more effective than the Navy's wildest hopes, despite limited numbers of the aircraft, carrying out 1,400 air defence and ground attack sorties supplemented by RAF Harriers during the campaign. The Sea Harriers destroyed over 20 Argentine aircraft and proved more than a match for their opposition, though at times air defences were stretched to breaking point, and anti-aircraft missile systems, particularly the newer Sea Dart and Sea Wolf, helped but proved less effective than expected. Blockade-running Argentine transport aircraft were able to deliver arms and equipment to ground forces through May and June. On both sides, helicopters were crucial during the land fighting, variously transporting troops and supporting them in combat with guns and missiles, and also being used for rescue. Ultimately, Argentinian air forces were, despite fierce resistance, unable to prevent the British amphibious assault from succeeding. While bombing and missile attacks caused significant setbacks for the British, air defence and air support ultimately made the recapture of the islands possible.
You're listening to Extended. Here are your hosts, Peter Johnson from XTP Media, Gareth Stringer from Global Aviation Resource, and Tim Robinson from the Royal Aeronautical Society.
Hello there, I'm Peter Johnson, and welcome to episode 70 of Aerospace Radio Station Extended. Today, I'm joined by Tim Robinson from the Royal Aeronautical Society, and Tim is the Editor-in-Chief of Aerospace Magazine. Tim, welcome back.
Hello there, Peter. How are you?
Yeah, not too bad, not too bad. Thanks. It's been a while, but we're back.
With a bumper episode.
Absolutely. And we welcome back as well the Executive Editor at Global Aviation Resource, Gareth Stringer. Welcome back.
Hi, Peter. Hi, everybody.
And the words you heard earlier were those of Naval Air Historian Matt Willis. Matt, welcome back to Extended.
Thank you, Peter. Delighted to be here.
It's great to have you. And as you've already heard from the introduction, this episode and the episode after this are going to focus on the Falklands Air War from a fleet air arm perspective. And in this episode, we get to talk to Commander Tim Gedge, AFC, Royal Navy retired, and Commander Larry Jerome Croft, Royal Navy retired, both with their experiences of the air war. But first, I'd like to say that this episode is brought to you with the kind support of Navy Wings. Navy Wings brings together flying historic naval aircraft, people, and the stories associated with flying from warships at sea. Navy Wings aims to inspire future generations and to create a focus for remembrance. You can support Navy Wings by becoming a supporter, making a donation, or becoming a volunteer. Find out more at www.navywings.org.uk. This episode is dedicated to all of those who did not come home. So let's get started by looking back at the campaign and the memories it had for us and what effects it has. Tim, let me come to you first. What do you remember of the campaign?
Only at primary school at that day, at that time. But I do remember a couple of things that will stand out. Obviously, the BBC reports, the Harriers going off, sort of being launched from HMS Invincible or Hermes, and you know, Brian Hanrahan saying, I counted them all back, and I counted them, you know, back
yeah.
in again.
Yeah.
That obviously is, you know, people glued to the TV at that time, but also a couple of years earlier, I think I'd been given an Airfix colouring book, and it had a rather nice Sea Harrier in there. You know, one of the things we're so I remember, I seem to recall at the time, I got very, very good at being able to draw a Sea Harrier, you know, kind of front on. Coming in quite kind of low and looking quite kind of worried. So I seem to recall that I drew a hell of a lot of Sea Harriers.
Mm. Matt, you're far too young to remember the campaign.
So not too dissimilar memories to those of Tim. Actually, I was at primary school in infant class at the time, and I remember sort of getting an impromptu lesson from my teacher because I'd memorized all the names of the ships, so my teacher was telling me what the origin of Hermes and who Hermes was and what the word invincible meant and things like that, and I actually remember seeing Sharky Ward landing the Sea Harrier at Pebble Mill at One, which must have actually been slightly before the Falklands itself, but yes, it's a sort of formative memory, really.
Yeah. On a serious note, Matt, this was the first conflict for the British forces for some time. We'd come through the Cold War era. Aircraft like the Sea Vixen and the Phantom and the Buccaneer disappeared from fleet air arm service. How well prepared do you think the Navy was for going to retake the islands?
That's an interesting question. I think probably better than many people gave them credit for at the time. But actually, my view on it is that an awful lot of the capability to retake the islands came through the traditions of the Royal Navy and the Fleet Air Arm in particular, and their historic ability to make the absolute most of the equipment that they had, and through training and tactics and that sort of tradition of making the most of things, that they were able to do that. But as you say, I mean, it was a huge leap from what the Navy had been capable of just 4 years before, in 1978, with the retirement of Ark Royal and the Phantoms and Buccaneers. It was a very big step into the unknown.
Yeah, and of course the Sea Harrier was very new. I mean, the Harrier itself wasn't long in service with the RAF, but the Sea Harrier was a completely new toy.
Yeah, I mean, it was a really... in some respects, it was an unknown quantity, as we'll hear from some of the people involved in the development of the Sea Harrier. They were very clear on its capabilities and actually had a very firm idea of what they had. But more widely, I think there was probably a sense that there was very little idea of what it could do and whether it would be able to do the roles that were expected of it. And again, if you look at some of the other systems, the Sea Dart, for example, and the Sea Wolf anti-aircraft missiles, actually a lot of the time didn't perform as advertised. So while there was a certain amount of confidence in the Sea Harrier from the pilots and the people who'd been developing it, there was really a sense that no one knew how it was going to work out when it actually got into combat.
Yeah. And just for a moment, just before we hear from Commander Gedge and Commander Jerome Croft, how well were the Argentinians? Because obviously they invaded the Falklands, they took the Falklands. How prepared were they from an air warfare perspective for what was going to come to them?
Well, in some respects, their air assets had been eroded over the previous few years through arms embargoes. They hadn't been able to maintain their fast jets in the condition that they, in an ideal world. However, they did have a decent force of A4 Skyhawks, Israeli Mirage ground attack versions of the Dagger versions of the Mirage, some Mirage interceptors, and they had an air-to-air refueling capability. They had an aircraft carrier. So bearing in mind that they had a conventional, a small but quite powerful conventional naval and air force air arm, with some aircraft that were capable of supersonic flight, and they had a lot more aircraft than the Royal Navy could fast jets. This is that they could bring to bear. There was a sense that they definitely had the upper hand in fixed wing air combat terms.
Yeah. Okay. Well,
the irony with that as well is that there were some newly declassified documents that were revealed from a couple of years ago, saying that the Argentinians in September 1981 were actually interested in buying a handful of Vulcans.
Right.
And it was being seriously considered. They were looking at sort of 12 Vulcan bombers. Defense attaché in Buenos Aires was saying, well, they probably these aircraft have no risk against the Falkland Islands. We should take advantage of this deal. Sell them some Vulcans.
Gosh,
I hadn't heard that. that would have thrown a different complexion on things, perhaps, I think. But the other thing to mention, of course, is the Exocet missiles from the Dassault Super Étendards that the that the Navy had, which obviously were potentially a very big threat to the Royal Navy task force, even though I think they only had five of them. But there were big worries throughout the whole campaign that they would manage to source another supply from somewhere like Libya. So this was a very big deal and a very big threat.
Let's listen to the two guests. We're going to run these interviews together. We'll have a short break in between. But first, we're going to hear from Commander Tim Gedge, AFC, Royal Navy retired. He flew the Sea Vixen, the Phantoms and the Sea Harriers for the Fleet Air Arm. Commander Gedge was the first commanding officer of 800 Naval Air Squadron when it was commissioned, first frontline Sea Harrier Squadron in March 1980 at Yeovilton. In early 1982, Commander Gedge was recalled to Yeovilton to hastily reform 809 Naval Air Squadron. He had 21 days to form and train the squadron before heading south. After that interview, we're going to hear from Commander Larry Jerome Croft, Royal Navy retired. Commander Croft spent 30 years in the Royal Navy. He trained as an aircraft engineer and then as a helicopter pilot. He was awarded the Queen's Commendation for search and rescue duties and flew the Lynx off of HMS Andromeda during the Falklands War. He's a prolific writer and is, of course, the author of The Definitive Guide to the Lynx. His book, The Royal Navy Lynx, An Operational History, can be found on the Navy Wings online store. Commander Tim Gedge, AFC, Royal Navy retired. Welcome to the programme.
Good to be here, Peter. Pleased, very pleased to be here.
Well, we're very honoured to have you on the show, and thank you very much for taking time out to talk to us. Tim, let's start a little bit before we talk about the Falklands and the whole Operation Corporate. A little bit about your career running up to the conflict. Can you tell us a bit about your Navy career?
Yeah, I started flying in a university air squadron, and I joined the Navy as a short career pilot for just 8 years at the beginning of 1963. I subsequently transferred after the 8 years to a full career, what was called general list career, and what this meant really in practical terms was if I did just 6 months at the beginning of my naval time of officer training at the Naval College at Dartmouth before flying training.
Right.
This meant that the training was very intensive, and I actually joined my first frontline fighter squadron after just over 2.5 years in the Navy altogether.
Wow.
But with well over 500 hours of flying experience, naval flying experience. Now, that sort of rate of flying is unheard of these days, and it really set the tone for an awful lot of what came after that. I became a qualified flying instructor after my first frontline appointment in the Sea Vixen. And I actually then instructed in Hunter aircraft at the Naval Air Warfare School at the Naval Air Station at Lossiemouth in the north of Scotland.
And in terms of those aircraft, you mentioned the Sea Vixen, and it's very close to a lot of people's hearts, I know, and the Hunter as well. The Hunter's always, pilots always talk to us about how easy an aircraft it was to fly. What was the Sea Vixen like?
The Sea Vixen was a huge aircraft and a relatively small aircraft carrier. And what a challenge and what an excitement for somebody as I was, just age 22, to find myself sailing around the Far East, Hong Kong and Singapore and Australia and into the Pacific in this carrier. I mean, that was a really, really exciting life. I had a couple of years in the squadron and then became a flying instructor, as I've said, and that was a lot of Hunter flying in the Naval Warfare School. And then we bought the Phantom at the end of the 60s, and so I was back at Yeovilton in Somerset. And by this time, I was the qualified flying instructor for the frontline 892 squadron, frontline Phantom squadron in aboard HMS Ark Royal. And again, what an exciting time that was. I was just 26 at this time, flying one of the world's fastest aircraft. I think the only comment I'd make is that we could have done with a slightly bigger carrier. It wasn't difficult, but it put limitations on the when we could operate in terms of ship movement and the kind of space that there was. There wasn't too much room for error in flying that aircraft. But after I'd done that for a year or two, I then transferred onto the general list of the Navy, as I've said, and I then went off to do the Air Warfare Instructor's course back at Lossiemouth, where I'd been before as the flying instructor, and now I was a student in the squadron. So I did the AWI course, and then I went off to sea for inside of a year in a frigate, and again ended up back in Singapore. But I was this time nothing to do with aviation. I was learning about all things naval.
Yeah.
And then following that, I came back to the Phantom, and I was, in due course, I was the senior pilot or second in command of the embarked Phantom squadron back again in Ark Royal. So that was the sort of, by this time I'd been through sort of two frontline fighter types and a lot of hunter flying. And then I went off to Dartmouth as the aviation specialist officer for a couple of years. And then I was with the Royal Marines for a while. And then I went off to do a staff course. So that was the sort of build-up to when I then went back to flying and learnt to fly the Harrier and then the Sea Harrier. So that, of course, then led.
So, Tim, tell us a little bit about that about the training to fly that aircraft, because you'd flown some very fast and capable aircraft, but how different was the Harrier to learn to take on?
It's in some ways very different, and in some ways, once you're up and away, an aeroplane is an aeroplane is an aeroplane.
Yeah.
So it's a question of what you're doing with it, and the flying of the aeroplane is only part of it. Of course, the in a military aeroplane, what the flying is all about is actually operating it in a fighter aeroplane. It's how to fight it. So we sort of take it as read that anybody can fly the aeroplane, but it's a question of how well people can fight it. But the Harrier is it's a challenging aeroplane. It's a very, very exciting aeroplane. You've got so many different ways you can land it. I mean, there are about seven different ways you can land it, from doing a sort of straightforward vertical landing to a conventional rolling landing, and then various other landing types of landing, short landings and so on in between.
Right.
Very, very exciting, very, very different. I don't think it was that difficult. You just had to learn the right techniques, and it was a bit unforgiving, so you had to get things right. I don't think any of us found it that hard. It was a challenge, certainly, but it wasn't that difficult.
And you started you learnt first to fly that. It wasn't, of course, the Sea Harrier came a little later. It was the RAF version, the GR1, that you learnt to fly on.
I went up to Wittering, the Royal Air Force station at Wittering, and did the sort of standard Harrier conversion. And then as soon as that was over, a couple of months later, I came back to Yeovilton and climbed into a Sea Harrier. And within about sort of 6 weeks or so of learning to fly the Sea Harrier, I was I formed 800 Naval Air Squadron, which was the first frontline Sea Harrier squadron. And this was... this was a real challenge. It was a blank sheet of paper, a brand new squadron. I wasn't taking over an already formed squadron. It was, it was all new. So I had 2 years with 800 Squadron, and then first of all we embarked in HMS Invincible in 1980, and then in 1981 we embarked in HMS Hermes. So I had the experience of flying flying off both these both the carriers as it happened. And where we were really, really lucky was that we were able to train and fight the Sea Harrier against pretty well every aircraft in the Western world.
Yeah.
With the carriers, we'd gone over to United States, to North America, and we'd done practice air combat against a whole raft of different types of American aircraft, and some of it on instrumented ranges. So we had this enormous advantage, really, after 2 years, that we really knew the aircraft inside out. Now, the problems, if we did have problems, were that the radar and some of the systems in the aircraft were being developed during that time. So we didn't actually have all the kit that we wanted for war fighting. But that apart, we were very fortunate. We had this a huge amount of experience by the time we actually got into 1982. Now, in my own case, I'd just handed over the squadron as CO in late January of 1982, and I'd gone on to the staff of Flag Officer 3rd Flotilla. And that was when the Falklands started.
And so, Tim, how did you hear about it, and what were your first reactions? Because most of the I remember it as a younger man, and was obviously glued to my TV as the news started coming in. How did it feel in the Navy preparing for war?
In a bizarre way, the morning that that it all blew up, most of the 3rd Flotilla staff were in a cinema listening to the Admiral explaining about a redundancy program.
And goodness me! Only in Britain.
A lot of the staff had been handed. A lot of the staff that morning had been given brown envelopes saying, you know, thank you very much for your year's service and you're being made redundant. The irony of this was that most or a lot of those people with the brown envelopes actually later that same day deployed to war. And as soon as they came back from the war, they were then made redundant. So it was a very bizarre time. But if I sort of look at my own experience at this time, I think I was extremely lucky. I was an A category flying instructor. I was an air warfare instructor, which is quite unusual actually to do both those courses. I'd flown, this was my third frontline type of aircraft. We'd fought the aircraft, the Sea Harrier, against all these different types of aircraft. So I felt pretty confident in my own ability. And that was, flying and doing practice fighting was not something that was that daunting a task. Now, on the morning that the Argentines invaded, in fact, I was invited to a very short notice to go up to Northwood to the Commander-in-Chief Fleet's office outside London. When I arrived there, having driven up there, I was ushered into a very senior meeting with a lot of very senior people. And asked the sort of hypothetical question that if the if we were to go to do something properly operational, how many aircraft carriers and how many aircraft or Sea Harriers would the Flag Officer 3rd Flotilla wish to take? And I said, well, where are we going? And I was told that I didn't have the right security clearances to know where we were going. but what was my answer to the question? Well, I came straight out, I have to say, and said, well, assuming we're going to the Falkland Islands, then we'll take all the aircraft carriers and we'll take all the Sea Harriers, knowing fully well that we only had two aircraft carriers and we only had 20 Sea Harriers. So there was a kind of sort of shocked silence that I knew. But what I had done was listen to the BBC radio in the car driving up. So yeah. The BBC were rather ahead of the ahead of the Admiralty at this stage on what was going on, I think.
Yeah.
Anyway, that having said that, I then drove back down to Portsmouth, where the headquarters was, and we started winding things up and getting the squadrons who were actually one was on leave and one was about to go on leave. We actually brought them back and arranged for them to embark. This was on a Friday, and they embarked over the weekend, and the ship sailed on the Monday.
And that was 800 and 801, and they went on Invincible and Hermes. And so you not only helped to mobilise them, but then you were asked to reform 809 Squadron as well. What was left, Tim, at that time in terms of aircraft and men?
Yeah, what we'd done was we'd augmented 800 and 801 with eight aircraft from 899 Squadron. The important thing here is that any naval squadrons with an eight in front of them actually had a sort of war fighting role. So the aircraft were equipped with the right equipment in them to actually as war fighters. So we put four of the 899 aircraft into each ship. As I say, the ship sailed on the Monday. After they'd sailed, I was sort of rather kicking my heels. Hmm. And it's probably worth saying at this stage that virtually all the aviation staff from the 3rd Flotilla had actually very curiously flown down to Gibraltar to join the Flag Officer 1st Flotilla staff. Now, the FOF 1 was the anti-submarine expert. It seemed inconceivable to me that if we were actually going to go to war, that we wouldn't send the FOF 3.
Yeah.
He being the expert, he was the carriers and amphibious ships man. He had the admiral himself had the experience of being the commodore amphibious warfare in an earlier appointment. So and all the staff were well prepared and trained to fight an amphibious war with the amphibious ships and Royal Marines and so on. So it was very curious to me that we actually were sending an anti-submarine expert with additional staff sort of tacked on. And I'll probably come back to that because it was I thought this was very strange. But it wasn't as though I was complaining, because that same day I had a call personally from Admiral Ted Anson, who was the Flag Officer Naval Air Command, and he asked me to come back to Yeovilton and to form another squadron with the sort of remnants that were there. And so on the Tuesday morning, I presented myself in his office, and he gave me a very simple remit, and that was, he said, go to the air station at Yeovilton, find an office, find all the aircraft you can, and find some pilots, and be prepared to go to war in 21 days, in 3 weeks.
Wow.
Now, that was a pretty simple and a pretty interesting remit. So, in fact, that's exactly what I did.
Yeah. But you didn't have – you had eight aircraft, but you only had six pilots, I believe.
Yeah.
Where did the other two come from?
We would have had eight pilots, but I wasn't allowed to take the Australian air warfare instructor that I had on exchange, and I wasn't allowed to take the US Marine Corps Harrier pilot that
right.
I had.
Okay.
So nor was I allowed to take the recently retired air warfare instructor, well-versed Sea Harrier pilot, who was one of the test pilots on the Sea Harrier for British Aerospace. Despite the fact that he was in the Royal Naval Reserve, I wasn't allowed to take him because yeah. Queen's Order 2 hadn't been signed, which to me was extremely galling. So,
the Australian and the US pilots on exchange, what were their views? Did they want to go? Would they have gone?
Yes, they were itching to go, I think, both of them. But yeah. This was a political decision, and they were not allowed to.
Okay.
So I was the only way around this, as far as I was concerned, was that I felt that I needed somebody who was a current on a Harrier, because we could train them to fly the Sea Harrier. I mean, it's not vastly different, and they needed to have single seat fighter experience. So basically, they needed to have done a tour in the Lightning aircraft. Mm-hmm. And be sort of second tour Harrier pilots. And there were two people in the Royal Air Force who met the bill, and they were given 24 hours to get from RAF Germany to Yeovilton and to do an instant conversion. And they did well.
And those RAF pilots, I've got to be honest, I didn't know that. Do they retain their RAF status, flying in a naval squadron?
Oh yes, they were just exchange pilots, and we had five exchange Royal Air Force pilots in the naval squadrons anyway.
Yeah.
So they just added to that, and I think the surprise to them was that, you know, they were climbing out of a mud moving Harrier ground attack version into carrying out a different role. But I don't think they had any great difficulty learning to fly the airplane.
So after 3 weeks, you'd mobilised a new squadron, and the plan was to meet up with the Atlantic Conveyor. How was the ship prepared for taking the eight aircraft?
One of the first questions I asked was how on earth were we going to get to war, because I'd seen the two aircraft carriers go, and I was told that wasn't my problem. But it very quickly came about that the Atlantic Conveyor had been earmarked, and I actually went down on the first Saturday after I'd formed the squadron to Devonport, to Plymouth, and went aboard Atlantic Conveyor, and we spent inside of an hour or two actually earmarking the things on the ship that we were going to cut off and some to leave. Basically, we left some of the containers on the deck to provide a sort of a shield against the weather. And we cut a lot of the fixing points and mushrooms and the rest of it off the deck. Decided how big the landing area was going to be and so on.
Did you have to strengthen the deck to take the heat of the exhaust?
It wasn't so much the heat, but yes, it basically over the forward hatch, there were large sheets of steel were simply welded in place. The ship was about 92 feet beam, and I remember saying to somebody that we'd make the whole thing square, because it seemed to me that 92 feet was about the same size as the Mexi strips that the RAF used in Germany for their field landing. The only problem I could see was actually how were we going to line ourselves up? Because when you're doing field landings, you normally put markers out ahead of the aircraft and to the side, so the pilot can line the markers up. But they're put several hundreds of yards ahead, and of course you can't do this in a ship at sea, because they'd be floating in the ocean. And so it seemed to me that we needed to keep the foremast there, which was, I think, 82 feet high, and we could use that as a reference point. So actually driving back to Yeovilton, I asked that by the Monday morning, this was on the Saturday, by the Monday morning, we had a crane with an 82-foot jib planted on the end of the short runway at Yeovilton, and inclined at 10 degrees, which is the angle of the foremast. And then on the Monday, it was one of these things that things were happening very quickly, and I have to say that the biggest problem I had at the time was not so much getting things done, but it was actually thinking what on earth it was that we wanted done. And so there was a huge amount of willingness of everybody to provide everything that they were asked for. The paperwork element had sort of disappeared. The bureaucratic element was non-existent. So when I asked for a crane with an 82-foot jib inclined at 10 degrees, it was there. Yeah. But nobody sort of thought to ask why it was there. You know, it was... anyway, I climbed into an aeroplane that morning and hovered with the nose of the aircraft a few feet from the jib, and then descended, coming backwards slightly, and that was that enabled us to land on this 92-foot pad that we'd put on the deck. The point really being that you can't see when you're landing a Harrier or Sea Harrier. You can't actually see below you.
Yeah, understand. So the Atlantic conveyor left, and you met up with her. You didn't actually ship out of Devonport, did you?
No, I went down on the 8 days after we'd originally been on board, took a Sea Harrier, flew down, did four landings and vertical takeoffs, and approved. It worked a dream. I landed from basically three different directions, and that was absolutely fine. The ship then sailed. During those couple of weeks, we did a lot of AIM-9 Lima Sidewinder firings, which had been scheduled for later in 1982, and... my old Squadron 800 were going to do the trial, but it was going to take something like 6 weeks. We actually fired six missiles in 2 days and from different directions against quite demanding targets. They all worked. And so that was that trial out of the way. And there was a lot of other things we did. We did the first sort of in-flight refueling with a Sea Harrier. Then, as I say, Atlantic Conveyor, she sailed. And then about 10 days after she'd sailed, we then flew down to Ascension in company with Victor Tankers. And actually, instead of going all 9 hours, I said we'd really prefer to stop because we'd never flown the Sea Harrier for more than about an hour and a half before. So we didn't know exactly whether everything was going to work. So... We stopped in Gambia overnight and then flew on down to Ascension.
Wow, that's a long staging. And I think the thing that I take from all you've told me so far, Tim, is that everything was new. None of this had been tested. So everything that was in effect going to war was pretty untested, including the pilots.
Yeah, they were. Untested operationally, of course, we'd done a huge amount of trials and practice, so we weren't short of practice of all the equipments, but we, this was the first sort of shooting war most of us had been involved in.
So, Tim, let's move on to that then. Atlantic Conveyor transited down to the South Atlantic, and near to the fleet, the squadron then was split, wasn't it?
I split 809 squadron in two. We put four into Hermes and four into Invincible, and I flew initially to Hermes and then over to Invincible. And we effectively ran just one Sea Harrier squadron in each ship.
Yeah. Okay. So let's talk about operations in the South Atlantic then. Atlantic Conveyor and 809 squadron arrived just after hostilities had taken place. What happened, Tim? You joined the squadron, 801 squadron. What happened next?
801 had been in action, as indeed at 800 in Hermes, and so they'd been the initial actions had taken place. Sheffield had been sunk, And so already we were suffering from the lack of the airborne early warning aircraft.
Yeah.
And I think my recollection at the time was, and we were about 2 days before the landings, which when I got there, it was 2 days before the landings were scheduled to take place. There was a certain amount of apprehension, I think, into how the how things were going to go once the once the ships went inshore and the troops started landing. But the initial actions had taken place, and the shortcomings of the Argentine aircraft, Air Force and Navy had already sort of shown themselves. I think putting myself into the shoes of the Argentines, it must have been totally devastating for them that none of the missiles that they fired against us worked or hit the target, and pretty well every one of the Sidewinder missiles that we fired against their aircraft struck home. So we lost no aircraft at that stage in air combat, and they lost quite a number. Now, from their point of view, it must have been totally devastating, and I suspect they were really wondering what on earth was going on, because there's nothing wrong with a Mirage aircraft or a Skyhawk aircraft. You know, the Israelis and other people who've used it operationally had used it very successfully, and they had a in numerical terms, and actually I'd asked for a briefing on the capability of the Argentine Air Force and Navy at Yeovilton, and the clever civil servant had come down from the MOD to brief us as a result of his research, and he told me that we were all going to be lost by the end of day two. All the Sea Harriers would be shot down. And I said, well, thank you very much. And I actually wouldn't let him talk to any of my pilots. He was extremely miffed at the time because he'd come all the way down to brief everybody. And I said to myself, you know, this is not the news we want to hear. And anyway, I felt he was totally wrong. But it was based entirely on the fact that numerically they had 11 to 1 against, in numerical terms, against us. Arguably, as we subsequently learned, it was 6 to 1 in terms of sort of operationally capable aircraft, but we didn't know that at the time.
No. And so, Tim, how did the Harrier perform, and particularly how did it perform for you? What sort of missions were you flying? Ground attack, combat air patrol?
We were doing, altogether, the Sea Harriers flew something like 1,500 missions, of which some were mixed missions, but of which about 400 were attack missions, and about 1,100 were straightforward air defense fighter-type missions. The aircraft was superb. It worked. It worked all the time. We lost virtually no missions through unserviceability. It was a relatively new aircraft, and it was well maintained. It was, you know, we were on top of the job, and the aircraft worked. Now, the things that didn't work were basically the. We'd done all the trials. I touched on this earlier.
Yeah.
But one of the things that that didn't work were the fact that if you loaded a live missile on the aircraft and then flew it in appallingly bad weather and threw buckets of seawater over it on the way, and then brought it back and then flew it and didn't fire the missile and then flew it again. You found that actually that was a trial we hadn't done. Normally when you do a trial, you load the aircraft, the missile on the aircraft, take it up and fire it. What you don't do is take it up and not fire it, take it up again, not fire it, and then invite it to work on the third. And so we hadn't done that trial. And another trial we hadn't done was to actually pour buckets of seawater over the aircraft, and in particular over the sort of computers in the cockpit.
That wasn't
part of the spec. So the moisture was one of the biggest problems, and we found that actually missiles had to be, they had to be dried out, and they were dried out in the bread ovens aboard the carriers. Wow. And and we used an awful lot of cling film, sort of kitchen cling film, yeah, over instruments in the cockpit to keep the moisture out. So these were sort of ad hoc remedies. But I
did read somewhere, Tim, a comment you made about flying off of Invincible. Sometimes if you timed it correctly because of the weather down there, you could literally fly off the end with less power simply by taking the opportunity that the dip in the sea gave you.
Oh, I think we were always using full power. What you did do was to time the takeoff so that you hit the ramp, top of the ramp, as the ship was pitching up and not down. And that was very much in the pilot's
repertoire,
under the pilot's control. Yes, yeah. I mean, it was something you learned to do.
And the weather was particularly bad down there. Maybe not bad, pretty normal for that part of the world, but it was challenging weather to fight in, let alone just fly. How was that? Because you were flying, you know, sometimes 3-4 or even more times a day. How did that take its toll on you? You know, the weather, the flying.
I think it's true to say that if we had not had the Harrier, the Sea Harrier, we would have, a lot of the time, we would not have been able to fly.
Yeah.
And I've said it a number of times that I think we would have lost the conflict, lost the war, if we hadn't had the Sea Harrier, because no other type of aircraft would have been able to operate all the time. I mean, the weather was appalling at times, the limits on sort of ship movement would have been just too great for normal aircraft carrier operations.
Yeah. And you flew, I think, 36 missions whilst you were down there. I mean, what is that feeling when ultimately the message comes for a contact and you have to go after that? What were you feeling when those messages came through?
I think my abiding memory was that really, I wasn't doing anything that I actually hadn't done before. Now, okay, we hadn't been in actual combat before, but at least to the same extent. But it was we'd done all the training, and we were very, very fortunate in being trained the way we were. The aircraft was working perfectly, as I said. The aircraft was doing everything we asked for it and more. What I saw was basically the enemy, the Argentines, doing things that absolutely, totally surprised me. They did not, to my way of thinking, they weren't making sensible decisions. They were... I mean, one of the sort of mistakes they made, I think, was they flew penny packets of aircraft against us. Had they flown a large number of aircraft against us, they would have really totally overwhelmed us, in my view.
Yeah.
As it was, they flew sort of 2 or 4 aircraft at a time. They also made a colossal mistake of attacking warships. Had they actually sunk the merchant ships that were in anchor and unloading, we would have lost the war because we would have run out of stores and supplies.
Yeah.
But they somehow thought that by attacking warships, they would make it easier for them to win. That was a bad decision. Now, I know the warships were well placed so that the first ships that they saw when they attacked ships in San Carlos water were probably warships. But they got that wrong, in my view. And the other thing they got very wrong was they basically didn't listen to the BBC World Service, who told them a number of times that the bombs that they were dropping were hitting the target, but they weren't fusing. The reason they weren't fusing was they were dropped too low. Now, anybody can hit the target by flying very, very low and dropping a bomb just before you get to the target. But you have to train and train and train to drop from a decent height so the bomb does fuse. Now, had they got fused bombs into the ships, that would have been, again, devastating for us. So they got that wrong. And to me, they were badly trained. They got they either didn't listen to their brief, or they simply didn't realize, or they didn't have the benefit of proper training behind them. And we were very fortunate that their training was not as good as it should have been.
But they were still tricky to run down. I think there's a story of not a story, there's an account of the pilot that was in fact shot down, and you were on combat air patrol, I think, when some Argentine A4s were coming in, and you were trying to dip in and out of the clouds at very low level to chase them off.
I mean, I don't know whether that's a function of their training, or whether they were just.
I don't know. Maybe the guts to do that low level running in. They certainly were trying, but maybe, yeah, as you said, their tactics weren't quite the sorts of ones that were going to win the war.
My abiding memory is that they didn't have the benefit of the training that we had. And if you look at it from our point of view, most of us had flown Phantoms or Buccaneers, and we'd done had a number of air warfare instructors, people who'd trained in the Hunter and knew how to fight aircraft at low level. And really, we were doing pretty much as we had trained. The terrain in the Falkland Islands is very similar to the terrain in the north of Scotland. You know, there were huge similarities.
Right, okay. Now, Tim, tell me, I think some of the experience you've already relayed to us led to you doing some shore-based activities. Tell us a little bit about that. Why were you inserted to San Carlos?
Okay, that was a sort of brief interlude at the last 3 days of the conflict, really. There were problems over the tasking of the Royal Air Force Harriers, the GR3 Harriers. And this wasn't their fault at all, but they were actually being tasked onto the wrong targets, or they were being tasked late onto targets. So when they got there, there was either nobody to no target to shoot at, or there was opposition when they weren't expecting it. And this was a function of the training and communications. And it was something that we had trained endlessly for. We trained in North Norway in putting HMS Fearless or Intrepid into Norwegian fjords. It's very much like putting the same ships into San Carlos water in the Falklands. So you've got high ground all around. And the people that were involved in the tasking of the RAF Harriers were, in my view, not getting it right. And so I was given a very simple remit by Admiral Sandy Woodward to go ashore and sort it out, which I did. But by the time I actually got ashore and sorted it out, we were on the last day of the war, on the 14th. To put it in context, by this stage, of course, the Sea Harriers had flown something over 400 attack missions. The RAF Harriers, they'd taken initially six down, then they flew another four down all the way down there, which was quite a feat in itself. But they only flew 126 missions altogether, so it was a fairly small, relatively small amount of flying they did.
So, but, So the end of the war came, and you returned to the UK on a tanker, I believe. But you then returned to the Falklands, didn't you?
Yes, I came back in the British Y, a BP tanker, 12 days up to Ascension, then flew back to the UK, had a few days leave, and then reformed 809 Squadron, this time with 12 aircraft, and we embarked in HMS Illustrious that had been brought out of the maker's yard in a rush, and we then sailed down to the South Atlantic, and by this time Invincible was down there by herself, Hermes having come back, and we relieved Invincible down there and kept the peace for the next 2 or 3 months until the Royal Engineers had rebuilt the airfield at Stanley, putting AM2 matting and portable arrestor gear in so that the RAF could operate Phantoms from there. So I had, during that sort of period, I kept at least two aircraft ashore at Stanley Airfield, and we kept the sort of air defense of the Falklands going in case there was a resumption of hostilities.
And by that time, Tim, and we talked earlier about the aircraft when the squadrons were originally mobilising, not having the radar ready. By that time, what sort of advanced early warning capability had been transited to the Falklands? Was there any?
Yeah, that's a good question.
Or were we still relying on the combat air patrols of the Sea Harriers?
No, we by this time we'd put some bigger fuel tanks on the Sea Harriers. We had doubled the number of missiles carried from 2 to 4. We'd put sort of double launchers on each of the pylons. And we had a sort of instant airborne early warning kit fitted into a helicopter. So this was all that happened in a great hurry. And that worked very well. I mean, it was just a shame that we didn't have any of that during the conflict itself.
Yeah. It is. But certainly what an amazing contribution the Fleet Air Arm and the Royal Navy made to retain in the Falklands. Looking back, Tim, and we approach the 35th anniversary of the end of the conflict as we're recording this. What do you think we took from that conflict from a naval aviation perspective?
I think there are a number of things, but basically, I don't think we learned any new lessons. The things that we did learn were somehow things that we had forgotten. But we knew, for instance, that that our aircraft, we had no airborne early warning, I touched on. We knew that we needed a radar that could look down and it could look down over sort of rough seas. There's nothing wrong with the Blue Fox, but it had a limited look down capability. And we knew we needed more missiles on the aircraft and so on. We needed a flare and chaff dispenser. We didn't have that during the conflict itself. So all these things were something that I actually, the following day, 1983, I went down to the Falklands as the Queen's Harbour Master for 6 months. But then I went up to the MOD and was actively involved, intimately involved in the development of the Sea Harrier, taking all these lessons aboard. So we developed the Blue Vixen radar that was a totally different radar, but that had a huge capability. It was much longer range. We developed the AMRAAM missile, or the Harrier to take the AMRAAM missile, hugely long range, so you could use that in cloud and bad weather and so on. And then at the time, I was very much involved in the development of the Sea Harrier replacement, which of course is now becoming the F-35. But it's worth saying that the in-service date for the Sea Harrier update, and I went up to the MOD in 1979. 84. The in-service date for the update was to be 1987. We actually got it into service in 1997, so 10 years later than planned. The in-service date for the Sea Harrier replacement was to be 1997, and we are now currently planning to get it into service in 2023. So the airplane which we designed in started in 1984, as I say, an in-service date of 1997, is going to come in 2023 and is scheduled to last for 50 years. Well, this means that that aircraft that we were working on is actually still going to be around 100 years after it was developed.
Wow!
I mean, this is a sort of I find this almost frightening.
Yeah.
But the real lessons I think that I learned were that you've got to fight in war as you train in peace. The bottom line is we've won, so I really won't sort of harp on the fact, but I believe we had the wrong organization in place to actually fight the war. We had the wrong staff fighting it, and to suddenly change your organization and form a new organization to fight a war is the wrong way around. Mistakes can be made. Now, the fact that the staffs involved in the ships did a pretty good job and won, I think, did them great credit. But I just, you know, wonder whether there was an unnecessary risk in this whole thing. But from my point of view, I was proud to be involved. The fact that we lost four out of the 23 naval Sea Harrier pilots down there was very, very sad. But let alone the whatever it was, 255 British servicemen and three Falkland Islanders that were killed. Very sad. From my point of view, I was very pleased and proud to have played a part. And I always sort of reflect on the fact that the reason we were down there, really, as I see it, was that the politicians who should have been stopping wars happening had actually failed to do their job. But that's another another.
Well, Commander Tim Gedge, thank you very much for joining us. Thank you for your service to this country and for the role you played. It's been a fascinating insight. So thank you very much for joining us and sharing it.
A great pleasure.
From across the globe, from the centre of aerospace, and now to you.
The Royal Aeronautical Society has a range of specialist groups which focus on a specific domain or discipline. They form a vital interface between the Society and the world at large, and serve both the interests of enthusiasts and professionals through debate, conferences, lectures and other activities. Learn how you can get involved. Visit www.aerosociety.com.
Not another flying magazine. The newsagents are stuffed with them. How can the aviation historian possibly be any different from the rest? Well, for a start, it's not a monthly, but a quarterly. It's compact format, not the usual A4, so it's great for reading in bed, in the bog, or in the bath. It doesn't cover the same old subjects, but tells you stuff you didn't already know. It's designed simply so it's easier to read, with no fussy backgrounds or overlapping images. And it's not in the newsagents at all. So check the website, theaviationhistorian.com, for more info. The Aviation Historian. It really is different from the rest.
Commander Larry Jerome Croft, welcome to Extended.
Thank you very much.
Well, thank you very much, Larry, for joining us. We're going to talk about your experience in the Falklands a little bit. But just before we talk about the Falklands, what was your Navy career leading up to that?
Yeah, I'm slightly unusual in that I'm actually not a mainstream pilot. I joined the Navy as an engineer and trained as an engineer, then an aircraft engineer. So that was my basic core discipline. But the Navy's quite enlightened and lets certain number of engineers go flying every year, mainly to do test flying jobs later on. So I got lucky enough to be selected to do that. And having finished my degree, my application course as an engineer and getting qualified, went right back to basics, went on flying training, and learned to fly up at RAF Leeming on Bulldogs, then flew Gazelles, the little helicopters we had at the time for training, then Sea Kings. And I spent my first operational tour in HMS Hermes flying ASW Sea Kings before I went and converted to the Lynx. So 12 years of the Navy before I even really got to do a proper job.
I'm sure that's not the case. Just the choice of a rotary versus fixed wing, was that a personal choice or was that something that the Navy encouraged you to do?
There wasn't any choice. At Leeming, they picked a couple of guys to go a fixed wing, and the rest of us went helicopters. I have to wonder sometimes what criteria they used. I was never offered the chance to go rotary wing, and frankly, I wouldn't have wanted to, because the choice was so limited in those days.
Right.
Helicopters, you had half a dozen types. It was Sea Harrier, Sea Harrier, Sea Harrier if you went fixed wing.
Yeah. Okay. Understand. So you went off to fly the Lynx, which was very new at that time, wasn't it? It was a new aircraft type.
It was a wonderful aircraft, and it was a step change up from anything we'd had at the time. I mean, the Sea King was getting a bit long in the tooth by those days. The Wasp was way past its sell-by date, and suddenly there was a shiny, sleek, fast, aggressive, well-armed airplane to play with. It was fantastic.
Yeah. And in terms of, it was a much smaller helicopter than of course, the Sea King. What about the change in role as well? Lynx was designed for a very different role, of course, from the work you were doing with the Sea King. How easy was that to adjust to?
Actually, in case of the role, quite easy. The real difference has been a member of a squadron, one of the pilots of an 8-aircraft strong squadron. I think we probably had about 11 or 12 crews. And suddenly, on a Lynx flight, you're on your own.
Yeah.
There's an observer sat next to you, but that was it. And you had to fly it. There was nobody to turn to. There was no senior pilot or training officer to turn to. You're on the back of a ship all on your own. And that was the key difference, I think.
And we've all seen those videos on YouTube and on the documentaries of the aircraft coming in to land on the bumpy deck of a frigate or a destroyer. What was your first landing on like?
Good question. Actually, not too difficult, because landing a Sea King on the back of an RFA was very much similar.
You get a T-shirt, yeah.
Yeah, putting a smaller Lynx on a smaller flight deck. But I do remember that when I was training, the first time we actually flew out from the coast at Portland to find this tiny little frigate in the middle of nowhere and go and do some deck landing practice on it.
Yeah.
I must admit, I do remember a bit of buttock clenching as I saw how small the flight deck was. But the aircraft was so capable, frankly, it wasn't a problem.
Yeah, okay. And of course, there was no autopilot in the aircraft. There were not all the digital aids that we have nowadays in aircraft. This was all hand-flown, wasn't it?
No, I mean, the Lynx had an automatic flight control system that gave you a height hold and a heading hold. So when you're operating, you could relax a bit and help the observer with the weapon systems. But
yeah.
When it came to the landing phase, no, that was all hands on stick.
Yeah, okay. In the lead up to the conflict then, you were assigned to HMS Andromeda, I believe.
Andromeda, yes. She was the first of the what we call the Batch 3. That's the last class of Leander-class frigates to be built, converted to carry the Seawolf missile, Exocet, and new sonars, and, of course, the wonderful aeroplane on the back, the Lynx. So we were the first to class, and very much initially an experimental ship.
Yeah, okay. And I look at pictures of her now, and she looks very small, actually, the Leander-class frigates. I mean, I remember growing up with them, and it's what I always called a frigate, was that type. But again, how challenging was it making that transition from those large aircraft carrying ships that you flew the Sea King onto to that small frigate?
quite challenging. And actually, the Andromeda had a particular problem because of the Seawolf system. She had a 967-968 radar on the top of the mast, which weighed 6 tons, and she rolled like a pig. And it was only when we went to other ships, then came back to ours, and realized how much she rolled, because, of course, you got used to it.
Yeah.
But, particularly at night, as you mentioned, YouTube videos of people landing, well, those are all taken in daylight.
Yeah.
Every time I see those, I just mutter under my breath, now try doing it when it's dark.
I've got to say, Larry, I mean, I always look at those and I think, God, what cojones those guys have got. I mean, that's amazing. I just wouldn't have the guts to do that. So I take my hat off to you on that one. So let's talk about the Falklands. Where were you when the conflict broke out?
I think I was in a rather seedy bar on the dockyard in Baltimore at the time.
Right.
The story is the ship had, because we were the first class, we'd gone out to the Arctic ranges in the Bahamas in January 1982 to do special trials on Stingray torpedoes. So we'd spent the rest in Baltimore. And we started getting funny signals asking us what was our weapon state, what was our serviceability state, without too much explanation. And, of course, we then watched the news and found out what it was all about.
Yeah. And did the ship depart right back for the UK then?
Not quite straight away, because we had quite an important trial to do down at the Navy Yards further down. So we spent a couple of days, but then we hung a big right and came across the Atlantic. And, of course, all hell broke loose when we got back into the UK.
Yeah. And when you returned to the UK, you undertook some particularly interesting development work, didn't you, in terms of preparing for travelling to the South Atlantic?
Yeah, there were two major ones. The first one, which is fairly simple, we were given a black box and told this is for the new Stingray torpedo. And the reason we were given that is that we actually had the magazines in the ship to carry the weapon, because that's what we'd been trialling in the States earlier on. So we were given this box, which replaced the standard torpedo box in the aircraft for the Mark 46 torpedo, and suddenly we were Stingray capable. The fact that we pretty had no idea of the tactics or how to use it really didn't matter too much. But, of course, the big one was that we were sent down to Leon Solent, and they started fitting electronics into the cabin of the aeroplane and a funny aerial. And within a day, we were flying against a Exocet missile head mounted on the head of Portsdown Hills to see if we could pick up the radar that the weapon uses and then jam it.
Right.
The reason for that is that an Exocet missile, if you try and jam its own radar, just says, thanks very much, I'll have you, and it goes straight for the jamming signal.
Yeah.
So the idea is the helicopter would have a jammer that would detect the weapon, retransmit the radio signal back to the weapon and make it come for you rather than the ship it was going for.
So, in effect, you were training to be a target.
Yeah, it sounds good, but the reality, of course, is that Exocet is a sea skimming missile. It can't climb. It flies at a preset height of a few meters, and of course we were at 600 feet.
Yeah.
But having said that, at the end of the period, we actually did live trials at Aberforth against the live missile, and all the range staff said it was too dangerous and shouldn't be allowed. So we ignored them. That was fine.
So you did have an Exocet fired at you in that. Working uptime?
Yeah, two actually, because the first one, we'd been told that if the there were two weapons in flight, if you stopped jamming an Exocet, it would take 2 seconds before it decided to go and search another target itself.
Right.
And on the first firing, we picked up lots of spikes on the instrument we had in the cockpit, and we weren't quite sure we were jamming the right signal, so we tuned off for literally half a second, and the missile flew over the target, which is a barge, close to where we were flying, and of course that was quite depressing.
Yeah.
When we got back, it was quite clear it was coming straight for us until we tuned off, and then they realized it wasn't 2 seconds, it was 0.2 of a second. So the next day we did it again, and we did it properly. Yes, and I'm probably the only person in the world who's flown a helicopter and seduced an active, real, live surface-to-surface missile to come for me rather than its target.
Gosh, again, rather you to me. But these were all serious exercises to develop the technology to take south with you, weren't they?
It was more than that. This is an exercise to prove that we had the technology that worked. In fact, when we landed on, then we had a commander from St. Fleet staff in the back, and he was straight on the phone to number 10
right.
to tell number 10 it worked.
Right, okay. And so how quickly then was Andromeda dispatched to the South Atlantic?
Well, straight after that, literally the day the trials finished, I never got to say goodbye to my family, just a phone call. We flew on board and off we went. There was, I can't remember, six or seven ships called the Bristol Group, headed by HMS Bristol, and we were going down as reinforcements. And I think by the time we arrived, we were more like replacements.
Yeah, yes. And when did you arrive, Larry? What was the timing of your transiting down to the South Atlantic?
24th, 25th of May we arrived. Earlier than that. Hang on, what's the date now? It was about 20th of May we arrived. I'm sorry, I haven't got my log.
No, it's okay. So the war was still pretty active at that point, wasn't it?
Oh, yeah. It was just getting into its stride.
Yeah. And so what was Andromeda, and more importantly, how was the were you and the Lynx deployed?
Well, now, this is a very interesting question. It's one of the reasons when I wrote my book about the Lynx helicopter, I wanted a particular section on the Falklands War, was to illuminate the fact that the aeroplane's primary role, and it sounds weird, was airborne early warning.
Right.
And the reason
okay.
for that was that we didn't have an AW capability. We'd given it up with the old Ark Royal. So we had to have some way of detecting attacks coming in by air on the fleet. And the Lynx was the first aircraft to be fitted with some stuff called Orange Crop. And Orange Crop is an electronic surveillance bit of kit which can listen to enemy radars. And you get a readout on a display, and you can hear it in your ears. And we knew exactly what the parameters of the radar and the nose of an Etendard radar were, which they had to turn on to get a firing solution for their exocet.
Yeah.
So most all the time in daylight hours, there was a Lynx 6,000 feet up ahead of the forts listening on this piece of kit for an Etendard attack.
Gosh, I wasn't aware of that. Lots of other
I mean, the aircraft carried torpedoes. We dropped torpedoes on what we thought were submarines. We didn't particularly, but others did. And the other primary role, of course, the aeroplane was the Seaskewer anti-surface missile. In fact, the first missile, the first weapons fired during the Falklands War was a Lynx from HMS, I think it was Cardiff or Gloucester, who fired on an Argentine patrol ship successfully.
Yeah.
And that Seaskewer missile, quite amusingly, wasn't even cleared for use. And in fact, after the war, they had to continue the proving trials, contractual proving trials, to prove it worked, having already fired half a dozen and sunk several Argentinian warships with the thing in the first place.
Yeah, I think I read somewhere that the Seaskewer had a 100% success rate in all of its firings in the Falklands. I think eight or so firings.
Yep, absolutely. And in fact, just going off topic very slightly, but in Gulf War One, two Lynx sank the Iraqi Navy with Seaskewer, and that's not an exaggeration, to the point that the Americans realized they had to go and buy missiles for their helicopters. It was a brilliant piece of wartime activity, and it was all down to a missile system that was we were the only people in the world who had it on a helicopter with that capability.
And so, Larry, tell us about what the helicopter was, what the Lynx was equipped with, and what missions you were flying in the Falklands.
Okay, well, apart from the airborne early warning, which was done using this piece of kit called Orange Crop, all Lynx always flew with Seaskewer. So one of our roles would have been, had the Argentinian Navy been stupid enough to come out in force, anything the Harriers had left to us, we'd have taken out Seaskewer long before anybody else could have got there. So that was the other primary role.
Right.
Anti-submarine with Mark 46 torpedoes, but there were an awful lot of ad hoc tasks. For example, taking special forces people into the islands at night, doing naval gunfire support, the ships who were lobbing shells into Stanley overnight. There'd always be a Lynx up spotting the fall of shell. A lot of reconnaissance work was done by the Lynx. The famous story of HMS Cardiff's Lynx, who was out to the west of the Falklands, in Falkland Sound, was actually attacked by two Argentinian daggers, the sort of Mirage versions, and out flew them. They didn't manage a firing solution on them because it's such a piece of kit.
Yeah.
So it was a real jack of all trades. Probably about the only thing it didn't do is troop lifting ashore because it didn't have the capacity, but it did just about anything else you could do with a helicopter.
Yeah. And so how much flying were you doing down there? I mean, talking to some of your colleagues in the Fleet Air Arm, there was very little time for anything other than active flying. What sort of pressures were on you as a Lynx pilot on a frigate, and what sort of flying duties were you undertaking? I mean, how long were you flying in a day, and what sort of pressures was that putting on you?
Well, as I said earlier on, you're the only person on the airplane who can, on the ship rather, who can fly the airplane, so you're watching on stop on, actually. And you'd get the odd quiet day. But most of the time, if you weren't flying, you're on alert to go flying. And I think, if I remember rightly, we flew 108 hours in the sort of 5 weeks we're down there, which doesn't sound much, but actually that's an awful lot of activity.
Yeah.
We didn't tend to fly at night too much because the Argentinians basically didn't attack at night, apart from one occasion when there was a false alarm, although we did do some night load lifting, which is meant to be illegal, but we did it anyway. But during the day, it was pretty high-pressure stuff.
Yeah,
and I think my record on one day, I think I did two refuels to give me three normal length sorties for about 7 hours. And when I got out of the aircraft, I literally fell over. I couldn't stand up because my back was completely gone.
Yeah.
So, yeah, we worked pretty hard.
And, you know, the stresses of being in a conflict environment, what was it like? I mean, there's only the two of you on the ship who can fly the helicopter. There's no replacement crews, I'm taking it. So you were pretty much on call 24 hours a day. And as you've just said, flying up to 7 hours, which, of course, is multiples of that in terms of prep and getting ready and debriefing and briefing and that sort of thing. How much pressure was that putting on you and your crew member?
You might find this a bit odd, but actually in some ways, yes, there was pressure in terms of the hours and what we were doing, but I think most of us were actually rather satisfied that our training worked. We threw quite a lot of the rules out of the window and just used our common sense rather than having to follow the rules. And I never really felt pressured in the way I think you're asking. I felt tired. I felt scared silly on a couple of occasions, but most of it was professional satisfaction that we were getting the job done.
Yeah.
I think the real problem, funnily enough, came after the war was over, because we were one of the late ships to get there, or also one of the last ships to get back. And that seemed to drag on more than anything else. But
sure.
No, the pressure was what we'd been used to. Don't forget, I was a Cold War warrior when I was flying Sea Kings and Hermes.
Yeah.
We were flying under the same sort of pressure because it's the Cold War. So although there was more bullets flying around in the Falklands, it wasn't step change, if that makes sense.
Yeah. And you were fired on.
Oh, yeah.
And you do recall, I think, on your blog, that story. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, it was 30th of May. It was the last Exocet raid of the war, and we were doing the airborne early warning role that I'd mentioned earlier, about 6,000 feet up ahead of the fleet, listening out. And funny enough, we picked up exactly what we were out there to do, which is a thing called handbrake, which is the code for the radar in the nose and atondar. At the same time, HMS Avenger, who was behind us, also picked it up, and we all reported it, and all hell broke loose, because by that stage, the fleet was very good at reacting to an Exocet threat. They turned towards the threat and fired chaff rockets and all the rest. And suddenly, Bob, my observer, and I looked at each other and went, ah, now what do we do? Because we knew there was a good chance that the Etendards, if they came in, would have escorts.
Yeah.
And we were unarmed. And although Cardiff had outflown some jets the other day, we're not sure how good we were. There was only one thing to do, which is run away. So we were looking for a nice big fat cloud to go and hide in, frankly. Unfortunately, the one we chose was back towards the force. And HMS Exeter, who had been tracking the four A4 jets that had come in with the Etendards, decided to open fire just as we flew into her radar beam that was guiding the missiles. And I don't know if I'm allowed to say this, but the exact words from my observer was, oh, shit, they're firing at us.
Yeah.
And I rolled the aircraft over and actually saw the smoke trail of one of these seat-up missiles coming up at us. So I shoved the nose of the aircraft down, and we dived from about 6,000 feet to 2. And many years later, I knew Trevor Eggington, who was the chief test pilot at Westlands, and tried to explain that no matter how fast he went trying to break the world helicopter speed record, I'd gone faster. But the difference is I was going down vertically and he was going horizontally.
Yeah. Yes.
But the interesting thing about that day, I mean, it was okay. The one Exocet was fired. It was the last one they had. it missed locking onto anybody until it went past the stern of HMS Exeter and locked onto Andromeda, my ship. And of course, we had Seawolf, which is one of the few systems down there that could shoot down an Exeter set.
Yeah.
And they were all lying on the deck with their fingers in their ears, hoping that it wouldn't hit them, but also at the same time hoping that the Seawolf would prove itself. And it ran out of fuel about a kilometre short of maximum engagement range, so they never actually fired.
Right, okay. And
yeah, when we got the ship, we got no sympathy whatsoever.
No, of course not, of course not. There's a healthy banter between the Fleet Air Arm and the the rest of the Navy.
Well, it helped. My chief, who ran the flight, when I got out of the aeroplane, presented me with a toilet roll, which I thought was a bit rude.
No, I get that. Going back to the threat then, the A4s escorting the Entendards, what were you picking up? Were you picking up the radar from the Entendards or from the actual missile?
No, it's the targeting radar called AGARV, which is in the nose of the Entendard. The only thing we saw of the A4s was when one of them got blown out of the sky by the Sea Dart that we got in the way of.
Yeah.
And it's interesting that one of the reasons I got involved in doing quite a lot of research on the 30th of May with some Argentinian and British historians was that the Argentinians claimed that that was the day they sank HMS Invincible, which is an interesting claim, bearing in mind I watched the whole thing happen.
Yeah.
And, of course, what happened was the four A4s, two were shot down, at least one by HMS Exeter, probably both, frankly, although Avenger claims she might have taken one out with her gun. Doesn't matter, two didn't make it. The other two tried to bomb Avenger and then disappeared. Those two pilots claim they flew right the way through the task force, saw Invincible, put a bomb down her after lift or something crazy like that, and then flew out, and it's sheer fantasy, which is a shame because they were very brave guys, but I don't know whether they're pressurized into making this claim or they just thought they'd done it. But it's caused a lot of angst between the UK and Argentina ever since, actually.
And it's still a claim that exists. I've read an awful lot about this, and there's still a belief that they did actually do that, isn't there?
And all sorts of claims about how we covered it up, like the Americans built us a replacement.
Yeah.
Or we sailed HMS Illustrious down there earlier. All a bit tricky, bearing in mind that none of that was physically possible. I mean, I saw it happen. I know what happened. I mean, I was operating off Invincible regularly for my ship. After the war was over, they sent Invincible up north to slightly warmer climates for a break just to get sorted out and then come back down again so Hermes could go home and Invincible stayed until Illustrious could relieve her.
Yeah.
And I actually spent a week in Invincible during that period flying their aircraft because mine was a bit broken at the time.
Right.
And trust me, Invincible did not get hit.
So when you flew from the carrier, obviously it also was had Sea Harriers as well. How did that work in terms of deck activity and things like that?
It's not a problem, really. The Harrier obviously needs a bit of deck to run up and take off. It lands like a helicopter. I'll probably get shouted at by somebody for saying this, but there was a big difference between Invincible and Hermes. Hermes is very, very busy, and if you went across to Hermes, they nearly always asked you to wait. Whereas if you went to Invincible, they nearly always got you on board straight away. It was almost like operating two different navies in some ways. But I can understand that because Hermes was horribly overloaded with Harriers. But no, it wasn't really an issue. We could land on the other side, for example. So the Harriers always approached the port side of the ship and moved to starboard. Both the carriers had room on the right-hand side of the flight deck. We could pop on out of the way. So it wasn't too much of an issue, frankly.
Right, okay. And then just working with the Harriers, you know, and we talked about advanced early warning. One of the first challenges when the fleet arrived, what was that over the horizon view, and the Harriers were used in terms of their radar for as far as they could look. How did you work together in that role?
Do you know, that's a very good question. Then the answer is we didn't. I think probably because by the time we got down there, the Harriers were too busy dropping bombs and shooting down Argentinian fighters. But one of the other roles, which I should have mentioned earlier, is called OTHT, over-the-horizon targeting, which is the Lynx particularly good at because the Lynx had a very good radar in the nose. So it's the sort of thing where the ship had a contact This actually happened to us just before we arrived. It was pitch black night, 3 o'clock in the morning. Suddenly the ship had a contact. Nobody knew who it was. Get the aircrew airborne, go and see what it is. Great stuff. But if it's an enemy aeroplane, if you can see him, he can see you.
Yeah.
So there's a standing joke. There should be a Potsimus VC dispenser on the dashboard of a Lynx. They never went for some reason. Well, we would go out and identify people. The orange crop would give us a bit of a clue if it's a warship because we could pick up the radars. But right. No, we didn't work the Harriers at all, really. They did their thing and we did our thing.
Right, okay, okay. Larry, running a little tight on time, looking at the role of the Lynx on a wider platform, of course, your book, which is the Royal Navy Lynx, is quote-unquote the definitive guide to Lynx in Royal Navy operation. How would you look at the role of the Lynx in the Falklands conflict? Looking back on it, what role do you think it brought and how would you describe it?
I think the thing the Lynx did in the Falklands was use that dreadful hackneyed phrase, it was a force multiplier. Without it, it's more better to ask what would we have done without it.
Right.
The ships wouldn't have been able to see what anything like as much as they could. The force would have been lost a major element of protection for this airborne early warning. They wouldn't have had the ability to get weapons into places that only the Lynx could get to. And they, dare I say it, the command in Hermes wouldn't have been able to think up quite a lot of good ideas, and which only the Lynx could then go and do, like getting these guys ashore in weird nighttime conditions. So it was a force enabler. It was a lot more than, say, the Wasp, which was originally designed just to carry a torpedo and drop it and go back to the ship. Yeah. The Lynx was very, very flexible.
Well, thank you very, very much for joining us and taking time out of your trip. And we won't enlighten the audience to that at the moment. But, Larry, you are a prolific author, as I said, and your book highly acclaimed and recommended to us by Roland White on the Lynx. But that's not the only book you've written. Where can we find out a bit about some of your books and your background?
Yeah, the very simple answer to that is Amazon. I do not, for my book about the Lynx, I have a mainstream publisher. My other books are self-published, and I do them through Amazon. So if you just put my surname into the Amazon search box, they'll all come up. I was told my novel about the Falklands would never work. Well, tell that to the 79 people who've reviewed it. And you'll see those. I've got a series of 8 about the Royal Navy, the modern Royal Navy, following the career of one guy. I'm just working on the 9th one of those now. I've got 3 about sailing in the Caribbean, which is something I used to do quite a lot. But all basically available through Amazon, including the operational book about the Lynx.
Well, we'll put links to those in our show notes. Commander Jerome Croft, thank you very, very much for joining us today.
Peter, thank you very much.
Extended. It's time to talk aviation. Email us now. Get involved at aviation-extended.co.uk. And remember, there's no E at the beginning of extended. Aviation questions, suggested topics, or even good old feedback are all welcome.
Amazing there, Commander Gedge, 22, flying the Sea Vixen at 26, flying the Phantoms off of Ark Royal. But some amazing stories there, drying the AIM-9Ls in the carrier bread oven and cling film over the cockpit instruments. I think we forget the ingenuity, Matt, of how some of the successes came about in the South Atlantic.
Definitely, yeah. I mean, no plan survives first contact with the enemy, I suppose. It's one of the, I suppose it's a cliche to say, is that one of the strengths of the UK armed forces is their ability to improvise, make do, adapt, overcome, and still kind of come through. I mean, one of the things I think was interesting, he said about, and Sharkey says the same thing, is about they had an air warfare expert who came down from, I'm not entirely sure it was DSTL. MOD in those days, and so said that they were all doomed.
Yeah.
And he got quietly kind of pushed away from the pilots, and that was your expert advice. There was, you're all going to die down there. It's a suicide mission. And the other thing I thought was interesting was that, he was sort of saying the Mirage is no bad fighter. It was supersonic. It was, got radar guided AAMs, and you're outnumbered as well. So you had, on paper, supersonic is going to win against a subsonic fighter, isn't it?
Yeah. I did put the question to him, though, about how he felt about going into war. And the key thing that comes over from all of these pilots is how confident they were in the equipment and, to a lesser extent, the procedures, but in themselves, in the training. I think he said, when I asked him about the training, he said, we take it as read they can fly the aircraft, it's how well they can fight it. And I thought that was a really interesting insight into how they tackled the campaign, because in my head I was thinking how difficult the Harrier is to fly, how difficult it must be to transist from a standard fixed wing aircraft. But what he was saying is once it's airborne, you fly it, it's how you fight it that counts. And I suppose that's really true, Matt.
Yeah, absolutely. And so much of the superiority of not just in particular the fleet air arm, but also in some respects the RAF is in the tactics and the training and the high quality of the air crew and the ability they have to do the job that all fits in around the basic ability to fly the aeroplane. And as you say, I mean, the Harrier, particularly this is the first generation Harrier, was not an easy aircraft to fly, and certainly in the conditions experienced in the South Atlantic, that was not something to take lightly. But it was that confidence in their ability to fight the aircraft and to make the best of the scenarios that they'd prepared for that made the difference, I think.
Yeah, and an interesting point he made about the tactics of the Argentinians as well. I think he called them penny packets of two and four aircraft in attack. I think it's quite clear that if they had used overwhelming numbers, not necessarily they could put them all up, but it would have been very different for the single and the pair of Sea Harriers to defend.
Yeah, very much so. And I think if you look at Sandy Woodward's book about the conflict, one of his abiding fears was of a massed attack that would be aimed at doing serious damage to the carriers, because without one of the carriers, it would have seriously compromised the operation. Without both of them, it wouldn't have happened at all.
Yeah.
And I think that there was that sense that by sending them through in dribs and drabs, they were not necessarily, it might have been more individually survivable. They might have been able to sort of get more, to do more damage per individual aircraft, but they weren't actually going to strike a killer blow against the task force. And I think that was something that ultimately went in British favour.
Well, I was going to echo that and say I think we underestimate the psychological aspect of kind of air warfare, and the balance, obviously, the Argentinian pilots, especially attacking ships at low level, was they were going in at ultra low level, because, you know, people are firing SAMs at you, people are firing Rapier missiles at you, people are shooting stuff out from the ships, but you fly higher and your bombs fuse properly and you're going to get shot down. And I think, you know, indeed, it sort of reminds me actually of some of the sort of current studies that were done on there's a very famous sort of RAND study done recently on China versus US forces in Asia Pacific, and the study concluded, using simulations, of course, that you know, if the Chinese all had a mass air raid at once, they would eventually win against sort of F-22s and F-35s, but it'd be the last two Chinese aircraft alive that would actually shoot down the tankers.
Yeah.
But at what point, you know, of when you're seeing your wingmen blow up and people go off the radio and them disappear, do you think, actually, you know what, I'll just sort of head back home or have a you know, an avionics failure or something like that and solve this for a game of soldiers?
Yeah. It was I particularly asked Commander Gedge there about being taken out of flying duties as well. I didn't quite make that point, but I thought it was quite interesting. They thought he was valuable enough to take out of being one of those 20 odd pilots to go and do some ground reconnaissance stuff and supporting some of the amphibious troops landing. I think he talked about supporting the RAF Harriers that were coming in doing ground attack. I thought that was really, really interesting. It just goes to show how thin the line of resources and capabilities was in the South Atlantic. If we had to take one of our 20-odd pilots, or by that time I think we'd maybe lost a few, I'm afraid, even more so out of flying to do that. It really interesting.
It was so thin. I think that's the thing that you keep coming back to, really, was that the resource in those aircraft and the pilots that could fly them, I mean, to the extent where they'd taken the Sea Eagle test aircraft out of the that was at Dunsfold, I think, doing tests on the Sea Eagle anti-ship missile, and it had to be taken back off that and put back into service. And unfortunately, that was one of the early losses, was that aircraft, because it wasn't fitted with the radar warning receiver that the operational aircraft were, because it had to be taken out because of some of the wiring for the Sea Eagle test.
Wow.
Material. So, you know, that was the number of aircraft was very low, and the number of qualified pilots, you know, was equally low. And it's the attrition that they were facing was, you know, it was really a case of who was going to run out of aircraft first. And, you know, that was a serious issue, I think, for both sides, obviously, particularly for the, you know, for the Royal Navy. And you know, the fact that there was those there was the availability of the RAF Harrier GR3s that came in and could take a bit of the load off the Sea Harriers in the ground attack missions. But when you look at the number of sorties that were done, I think it was over 1,400 sorties that were done with Sea Harriers, and it was something like 140 with the GR3s. So, you know, it was still a thin resource.
Well, let's talk about Commander Larry Jerram Croft then. I'd not heard either of the stories. He's got to be one of the only pilots who's had to dodge a friendly Exocet and a friendly Seawolf. I mean, amazing story.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that it was a very real danger for the helicopter to pilots to be in the thick of that, and to hear some of those stories with you know, fast jets and missiles, you know, dodging this way and that is, and you know, to have to remember that actually it was one of the Army Gazelle helicopters, I think, was shot down by was misidentified as an Argentinian aircraft and was shot down by a friendly SAM from one of the ships. So it was the risks were very high. And you know, to hear his account of that attack on, I think it was HMS Avenger and some other ships that were around there on the day that the Argentinians claimed that they bombed Invincible I don't think I'd heard a first hand account from the air before, which, you know, is pretty astonishing stuff, really.
Yeah, it was amazing content, and we brought it all here on Extended. Commander Croft also talked about differences in the two carriers. It seems to be an interesting theme there about the way the two carriers operated. Maybe that's something, Tim, you can ask our guest on the next episode. Matt, just coming back to the Lynx. The Lynx was pretty new in the conflict, but Commander Croft there talks very highly of it, very capable. And in both of those interviews, the lack of AEW aircraft, of course, we no longer had the Gannets or anything like that once Ark Royal had gone. Amazing that we were using Harriers and Lynx as guards, in effect.
Yeah, absolutely. I'd never heard that before, that Commander Jerome Croft suggested that they were using the Lynx not just as a, you know, for Exocet jamming, but also as a sort of rudimentary airborne early warning. It just brings it home just how, you know, just how limited the forces were there in that resource. And again, it was a major problem during all of those operations that there was no airborne early warning, and sort of having to sort of position ships up threat to use their radars and as you say, Sea Harriers and so on as well. And again, the fact that not only did were there such limited resources in helicopters and fixed wing aircraft and ships, but they had to be used for all these very high risk activities as well as what you would normally expect them to be able to do. So you know, pretty remarkable stuff, really.
Yeah,
and the thing he was talking about, the orange crop, is just an ESM. You know, it's a radar, passive radar warner. Really, it's not going to give you range, or it's not going to give you a height of anything. It's just going to give you a spike on a certain direction, saying you know, that there is something there, but we don't know how far away it is or what height it has.
Yeah. And then just that sort of that few seconds extra notice of an incoming threat was just any help they could get, I suppose.
Navy Wings is the brand of the Fly Navy Heritage Trust charity, which operates and supports the Sea Vixen, Two Swordfish, Sea Fury T20, and more. The charity relies on public donations to keep the nation's historic naval aircraft in the skies as a focus of remembrance, inspire future generations. Sign up as a supporter to take advantage of unique benefits. These include visits to the Heritage Hangar, entry into prize draws to win a flight in one of the Heritage aircraft, and discounted Yeovilton Air Day tickets with access to the exclusive Navy Wings enclosure. Let's move on then to wonderful interviews. But we went on to ask our good friend Simon Jakubowski on the Facebook Aviation Enthusiast Book Club. Give us five books he would recommend for our listeners of this show to read. Now, we'll just park any books from Commander Croft and of our future guest as well. So we'll park those. But the five that he's highlighted are the RAF Harrier Ground Attack Falklands by Squadron Leader Jerry Pook, MBE DFC. Air War South Atlantic by Alfred Price. Vulcan 607 by our very good friend Roland White, who, by the way, recommended Commander Croft for our Lynx episode. So he did come highly recommended. Hostile Skies, The Battle for the Falklands by David Morgan. And Wings of the Malvinas, The Argentine Air War Over the Falklands by Santiago Rivas. Now, I had to, when I got this list from Simon, make a confession. I'd only read Vulcan 607 from that list. A bit embarrassing, I'm sure. Pick up any of the others, Tim?
Yeah, I really recommend Dave Morgan's book on Hostile Skies. Yeah, that's a great read.
And how about Wings of the Malvinas by Santiago Rivas? I'd like to get my hands on that, actually.
Yeah, that would be good, I think. You know, get a different perspective. There's some other good ones that have popped up here and there. There's one called Scram. I've not read that, but that's looks to be about helicopter war in the Falklands. There's of ones that are still on my to-do list, you know, to read list.
How about you, Matt? Any good reads from the conflict other than the ones we've mentioned?
Yeah, I mean, well, there's so many books. I mean, I would recommend 100 Days by Sandy Woodward as a really good overview of the conflict. And obviously it's not just focused on the air side of things, but in a sense it's you know, valuable for that. And he does have a very strong awareness of the air side of things, and that does get good coverage. And actually in the more recent editions there is a response that he's added to the introduction that responds to some of the issues that Sharkey Ward raised in his book. And so it's interesting that there's that dialogue going on between those. And of the actually the Jerry Pook book is that's almost like the sort of the mirror image of Sharkey Ward's book. In it is quite controversial in some respects. There is a lot of the inter-service rivalry stuff going on, but it is very good on as an account of the Harrier GR3 operations, which I think otherwise there isn't a great deal written explicitly about. Other than that, that there's again not specific to the Falklands, but a recent book called Fighters Over the Fleet, Naval Air Defence from Biplanes to the Cold War by Norman Friedman, is actually very good on the development of all the various systems that were used in the Falklands. So the development, the Harrier carriers and the Sea Harriers themselves, and the various the radar and the weaponry that they used from a very sort of from a conceptual perspective, which I found very interesting and a sort of quite a new take on the subject.
Gareth, I've got to call you in. I know you love your books. Did any of these appeal to you? Have you read any of these?
Yeah, quite a few of them actually. I would really concur with what you guys have all said. 100 days is essential, I think, as an overview piece from kind of the man that was in charge of the whole shooting match, if you like. Jerry Pook's book is brilliant, and as Tim said, Dave Morgan's is well worth a read as well. I would like to read the Argentine perspective though, definitely. I've not read that either.
Yeah, and we do have an intention to, at some time in the future, see if we can produce a third episode looking at the Argentine perspective of the air war. So if you feel you can contribute to that, do get in touch with us. Okay, let's move on then. We don't have a promoting aerospace segment in this episode. Of course, we are supporting Navy Wings, and particularly so because of events in the last week or two. I think everyone is aware that the last flying Sea Vixen had a belly-up landing at Yeovilton due to a hydraulic failure. Commander Hargreaves made a superb landing. That aircraft is fully supported by the charity Navy Wings, and we would like to do everything possible to help support getting her back into the air. At this point, we're not clear about how much damage there is to her, but for all the other aircraft and for the Sea Vixen, anything that you can do to support that would be gratefully appreciated. On top of that, Lewis Gaylard, of course, who wrote the book about that airframe, Foxy Lady, has produced his latest version, which is a look back over last year. And if you're interested in that, go to navywings.org.uk and you can get a copy of it there. There are some fantastic photos in there. It is absolutely rammed with photographs, and it's a year in the life of Foxy Lady. So let's see if we can help get her back into the air. The Fly Navy Heritage Trust, under the brand Navy Wings, relies on public donations to restore, maintain and fly a collection of historic naval aircraft. To help the charity and the Sea Vixen, sign up as a Navy Wings supporter, donate or shop in the Navy Wings flight store. Thank you for your support. Okay, that is it for this episode. We'd like to thank White Hearts and Peter Dixon for their contributions to the show. We'd also like to say a big thank you, as I mentioned then, to Lewis Gaylard. He's helped us produce this episode, and you can find his latest book, of course, Foxy Lady, at the Navy Wings store. We'd also like to thank the BBC and the Smithsonian Channel for the use of their content. You can find Extended on Stitcher.com, UKpodcast.com, thepoddirectory.com, and of course iTunes. If you are a listener to any of the podcatchers, including iTunes, please leave us a review. Our legal policy and use of our material can be found on our website. Please do ask before using anything you hear. The programme is produced with a Creative Commons licence. Okay, guys, where can we find you online? Tim, let's start with you.
I'm on Twitter @RES@RES Tim R, and you can find the Royal Aeronautical Society, www.aerosociety.com.
And Gareth, where can we find you online?
Yeah, it's Gareth_Stringer on Twitter and globalaviationresource.com for everything GAR related.
Now, Matt, we haven't talked about any of your latest productions. That's because we want to get you back. But where can we find out about you online?
I'm at Naval Air History on Twitter, and navalairhistory.com is the website.
Excellent. You can find me at Nascot Hornet on Twitter, and of course at xtpmedia.co.uk. Now, our next episode, which we hope to have with you in about a week's time, is the second part to this Falklands Air War feature, and it includes an interview with Commander Sharky Ward, DFC, AFC, Royal Navy, retired. Now, I can say that Commander Ward is not backward in coming forward about his views on the war and the ramifications for the current Royal Navy Fleet Air Arm. I can genuinely highly recommend that you stay tuned to Extended for this next episode. It's not to be missed. So, with the arrival of the music, it's goodbye from Matt Willis.
Goodbye.
It's goodbye from Tim Robinson.
Goodbye all. See you next time.
Goodbye from Gareth.
Goodbye.
And it's goodbye from me, Peter Johnson. Remember, stay tuned to this frequency. That is, of course, Aerospace Radio Station Extended.
Extended would like to thank its partners, Global Aviation Resource, the Royal Aeronautical Society, and XTP Media, for their support in helping to present and produce the programme. Thanks for listening to Extended. We'll see you next time. And don't forget, we want you to contact us. So get involved at aviation-extended.co.uk is the email address you need. Extend it.
This is XTP Media.